from another warehouse to Staten Island, and then they give it to me. Those are the days where, instead of it being overnight or the next day, it's 5 days or so. But, again, as long as I don't have to work for them, it's a very, very convenient and, for the most part, cost-effective. Occasionally, if I buy a big-ticket item, like I bought my Sonos speaker, I tend to buy at B&H. They have a warehouse in New Jersey, but if you use their credit card, they give you the sales tax back, which is very nice. That's 8% and change. So, you know, for 8% and change, I've never had a problem returning things at B&H. And so, you know, for some occasional products that B&H have that are big ticket items, I look at the amount of taxes I'm going to pay, and I occasionally order it through B&H instead of Amazon. Okay, it seems that we've kind of, beaten this one to death. Rich had a request, as I mentioned earlier. Unfortunately, I have been radio-free for at least HF radio for a month now, unfortunately, but soon to have it back. So for you people out there who are regularly listening to the HF bands, it was my understanding as well, just hearing secondhand, that 10 meters is waking up again, which is a good thing to hear. But if anyone would like to mention how the HF bands have been this last few weeks, please feel free. Okay, unfortunately, that's about 90% noise, 10% voice. So if you could raise the gain, adjust the antenna, move around a little bit, what have you, please try. Yeah, unfortunately, that didn't help. Now you're dropping out of the repeater in the middle of the, 85-90% noise.
Kilo 2, Fox 2, Newport.
Yes.
James John, Connecticut. I listen from time to time. I had a chance earlier today in order to listen to 10 meters and a Pennsylvania contest earlier around 6:30, but 10 meters out of five was nice and over.
Yeah, very good. I'm glad to hear that. Hopefully it'll continue once I get my radio back. Thank you for that report.
AE2ALP.
Yes, ALP.
Name is Ivan. And I'm more of a listener on the HF right now. I'm a light shortwave radio. And my receiver on 10 meters was very busy for the last couple of days, pretty much. You know, all the frequencies are... either was probably a contest or something, but I've heard DX stations from all over the world. Norway, Germany, Russia, Great Britain, Ireland, Italy, all these countries, and it was just amazing how clean and clear the signal was, almost like, with a minimum background noise. But then during nighttime, I wasn't able to tune in to anything. So it was pretty closed during the nights that I've been monitoring it last night and a couple nights before. Maybe it's just my antenna or my location, but I'm using a W6LVT indoor loop antenna, which is a pretty great antenna, magnetic loop. It's a active loop. And, I've heard some stations before on 10 meters during nighttime. Yes, that happened, but not lately. Over.
Okay, thank you very much, Ivan. Yeah, that's a more common situation. Occasionally, you will get good propagation during the night, but primarily the way that things like 10 meters propagates is off the highest F1, F2 layers of the ionosphere that light up with the sun. So when the sun goes down, usually they slowly dissipate, de-energize, and they stop refracting the RF back into the Earth, and it just goes off. So you'll get your best propagation usually in the middle of the daytime, as opposed to things like 80 meters and 160 meters, which they're harmed by the ionospheric D-layer. It generates a lot of noise on that band, and the noise overwhelms the signal. So for 80 and 160, you'll get the best propagation and ability to hear signals at night when the D-layer is de-energized. So although, you know, things sometimes don't go by the book usually suggests that daytime is best for 10 meters and nighttime is best for 80 and 160.
EDWS, friend.
Yes, Paul?
I remember Rich says he's he likes 40 meters CW, and I was on last Monday on 40 meters, and it was busy, you know, all kinds of, you know, the whole Northeast, I could hear stations, so I sent CQ, and I wound up with a guy from Westbury, so I figured I was going to make a bunch of contacts. I just stayed on with that guy for like about an hour going back and forth, so yeah. And that was it for me. But yeah, it was open at 7 o'clock on 40 meters CW. And I suspect that, you know, the rest of the week is probably the same as well. But I'm not sure. I haven't been on quite a few days. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. It's good to hear that the bands are open. I went through that terrible summer on 10 meters. In spring, it was delightful. I was so active that I had to move the net's frequency because people were using it before we began. It's always polite to move to a nearby frequency and not tell guys having a conversation that you were there first 15 years ago. But those days were gone. The summer was dead as anything. It was back in the middle of the sunspot minimum. I couldn't even talk to guys in New Jersey. It was basically Brooklyn, Queens. So I'm very glad to hear that things are better. I hope it continues when I finally have my radio, plug it in, turn it on, and go back on 10 meters. So thank you, Paul. Anyone else with who wants to report what the bands are doing in the last month?
ADP to you.
Yes, Alex.
So about last week in 10 meters, I had vacation to burn, so I sat at home all week. My girlfriend and I took vacation. On the 12th, I got, normally I hear nothing on 10 meters. It's tough for me to get contact once in a while. But on single sideband voice, I got Russia, Croatia, Poland, Lithuania, Spain, Hungary, Italy, and Ukraine. I was happy to finally get Ukraine on single sideband, but the 10 meters was just looked like a normal band, not like the noise it normally is. I thought my antenna doesn't work. Apparently it works. 82.
Oh, okay. Very good. You know, a couple of months ago I mentioned that I got into Africa, which is always nice. I don't think I've ever reached East Europe. It's been kind of the coast of Europe. I spoke to Ireland and Scotland and England. I'm trying to remember if I talked to France, but I never really got much farther than that, I don't think. So that's very good. Once again, I'm looking forward to my Flex arriving, and I'll plug it in and turn it on and see what's going on 10 meters. Well, once again, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Landmark Technical Net. If anyone has any amateur radio-related questions or comments before we move on to the non-amateur radio-related section of this technical net, then please ID yourself, give me your call sign, your first name.
WB2BXO here. How are you, Roy?
Yes, hello, Frank. How are you today?
Yeah, I think conditions have been relatively good. I work there were a couple of the expeditions on in the Pacific. WAS on Swain Island, T2C in Tuvalu. I think there's one other. Oh, yeah, those are the two in the Pacific. And ZB9W, middle of nowhere in the Atlantic, Tristan de Gumba Island, I think it's pronounced. Anyway, a buddy of mine on the West Coast running 100 watts to one of these Miracle Whip type antennas on the balcony worked both the Swaim Island and the Tuvalu station. I worked the Swaim Island expedition on 17-meter CW. Finally got him, which is good, considering that I think he's leaving the island on Tuesday. So I agree, conditions have been relatively good. Certainly a lot better than they have been. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, very good. I'm very optimistic when I finally get an opportunity to turn my Flex 67 on.
Yeah, you had to send back your Flex, so it wasn't clear what happened. I thought they could fix everything with software in those things.
Well, surprisingly not. There's a lot of things that they can't fix with software. Even when occasionally the software will kill the radio. They had a firmware upgrade that corrupted the SD card that is the boot-up instructions. And being a paranoid group of people, they encrypt the SD card. For them, secure disk is just not a fancy trademark name. It's a secure disk. So I needed to have a new SD card. They had to ship me one, and I had to ship the broken one back to them. I couldn't even just download the software, burn it to an SD card, and plug it in. So, no, it's amazing the degree of things that have to be sent back. In the old days, they would have probably told me to send it back because you have to peel off the RF cage that says, caution, if you remove this sticker, you void the warranty. But they said, go ahead and void the warranty. But in this particular case, what's going on is it's a computer. So like most computers, it has fans on it. It has fans glued onto the field programmable gate array chips. These are very sophisticated integrated circuits that when this model was first developed 10 years ago, the unit price for one chip was $1,000, and this one had two of them. So in order to replace the fans, I would have to remove the heat sinks, and I would have to unpeel them from $1,000 integrated circuits, which I chose not to. I tried to blow it out and clean it other ways. It needed to be replaced, and there were no simple replacement parts available. So I sent it back to Austin. They kept it on a shelf for about 3.5 weeks because they're backed up, and then they finally got around to it. And they swapped out all the fans. The chip fans were the problem, but there's two other fans on either side of the chassis, and they said, they're looking a little aged, you might as well have a refresh and get new ones. So I said, yeah, sure, it cost me an extra $40. But it's like a computer. The first things to go on my computers tend to always be the fans.
Yeah, well, the fans are the only mechanical parts. Of course, the mechanical parts are...
I find that to be the case. Usually the ball bearings kind of finally crack, and it wasn't the case of the radio, but I've had laptops especially where the ball bearings crack and it sounds like a small 747 is going off instead of a laptop fan.
Yeah, gotta love those fans. I remember the fans in a federal office with lousy air conditioning years ago. and we used to have a big propeller fans in one section of the office. It sounded like we were sitting on one of those old constellations all day.
Yeah. I mean, they're making them a lot better these days, but that costs manufacturers a little bit more. They tend to like to cut corners, especially when it comes to things like fans. I've had my Lenovo laptop for 5 years, and I've had the fans replaced twice under warranty. Unfortunately, now the warranty has expired, so I went over to eBay and found a source for replacement OEM manufacturer's fan assembly, and it's a little bit esoteric because it not only has a CPU pad, but it has a graphics chip pad as well. So I bought it and I put it away in a drawer, and when the inevitable happens and it needs to be replaced, I'll simply do it myself.
Yeah, very, very good. Anyway, I'll let you go on with the net. Just thought I'd answer your question about what I've been seeing on HF. It's been fun lately. I still need 6 countries to complete the XCC on 12 meters, and with conditions as they are, hopefully that'll be done pretty soon. I have 100 on 80 meters, which would qualify me now for 5-band DXCC, but I want to have a couple of extras before I submit that, even though I think when they're in LOTW, they're all automatically accepted. If any of the serious paper chasers on here can confirm that to me, that might be helpful. Anyway, go ahead with the net. WB2BX, so good to talk to you again.
Likewise, Frank. Yeah, this might be a good opportunity to throw out a little question to people listening. They might know, they might not know. I was going to buy the original fan heat sinks that came from the my radio. Haven't been manufactured in years, so there's no real source for them. The replacement parts that the Flex Radio people use to replace the old ones, though, is. So I went to the website of the company that manufactures them, and they appear to sell them in lots of one. Major companies that people buy electronic parts from, I forget the names, I think only sell them in lots of 5 or 10. Seems like a waste of money. At most, only need 2. So I went to the original manufacturer that sold them in lots of 1 or 2 or 3, and I ordered it. A couple days later, I get this weird email that says, we don't sell to individuals. We only sell to businesses, so we're going to cancel that order. Have a nice day. So I wonder if anyone has the faintest idea why someone who sells in single units cares whether it's a company or an individual.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Granger Company, you know. If you're not a business, they're not going to sell you anything. They won't sell you a screwdriver. There's one out by me, and I walked in. I think, let me buy, you know, I want to buy something from them. You know, and they advertise on. I hear them on WOR radio like 100 times a day, advertising. You walk in there, and if you don't come in with a number showing that you're a business, they won't sell you a screwdriver. Back to you.
Yes.
Roy, kicking it to me. K2SDP.
That's Chris.
They will do that, or I should say always, they do that because they have agreements with the manufacturers for them to be a distribution point or a distributor, and they have to sell to business, so they can't sell retail, and that's generally why they do that. K2SDP.
Oh, okay. It's a shame. I, you know, the back of my mind, I tend not to lie about things. So, it, you know, there was the entry, first name, last name, address, company. So I just wrote parentheses, personal, in parentheses. I wonder if I had written, you know, RSL Co. Incorporated, whether they would have just shipped it and be done with it or require some other form like a tax number.
Yeah, they'll usually, or I should say again, they'll always ask for a resale certificate with your tax number on file to create the account, and then you can order whatever you want, because then you're a retailer, so you have to have a license, you know, you need a tax ID and a license of some sort. But that's why they do that. The company I used to work for, even though they were in a biotech field, we did the same thing. We had you know, distribution points, and we were not allowed to sell. Customers called all the time trying to buy biotech stuff, and first of all, legally we couldn't sell it for security reasons, but besides that, we had agreements with distribution points that we couldn't break.
Okay, thanks, Chris. It makes sense to me. It's unfortunate, but that's life. In the previous fan had a similar problem. When it was available to anyone, it was only available in stocks of 10, and most people don't need 10 fans. I mean, the radio only can use 2 fans. Back in those days, there were enough people having fan failures that he basically sold the excess 8 fans to other people on the Flex Radio Forum, and everyone was happy. But that was back in 2017. So we're talking 6 years ago, so that supply has gone away, of all things. So, I don't know, another little interesting thing I discovered. Thank you, Chris. Any other comments before we move on to Wesley? I take that as a very, very quiet no. So, Wesley, what's your subject for tonight?
Okay. We have car replacement, battery car replacement. So people use lead acid batteries, and now we have a chance to use capacitors instead of car batteries. I think that might be interesting to some of the people.
Okay, I think the gentleman defined it as a supercapacitor. You know, it's kind of an arbitrary name for a very high capacitance electrolytic capacitors. I think on that YouTube, it sounded like he had had them for years. He kind of brushed them off and put them together and made them work. I will be curious to see or hear if it goes well for a long period of time. He seems to believe that it will maintain itself for the life of the car. I don't know. So it certainly is an interesting situation. My guess is there's got to be a couple of gotchas, because I have not heard of anyone else doing this. And, you know, the guy who first invented the wheel was a clever guy. I don't know if he invented the wheel, this guy on YouTube. So I don't know if there are some hidden gotchas down the road. It'll be interesting to see if he indicates that.
Okay, so from the search in the internet, I found that capacitors can make traditional 12-volt battery obsolete. And the term in the video, if you find suitable, some links that I have sent you to publish on your website, please do so. He actually used a number of super capacitors. He called them ultra capacitors, and his battery, instead of 18.4 kilograms, which is 36 pounds, was about 3.5 kilograms, which is about 7 pounds. So that is one change. What he did is he used a 3D printer to print the enclosure, and he put capacitors inside, connect them in series, and then he was able to run his cars out of it. It looks pretty amazing to me, so I decided to give a search. Let me drop. I found that ultra-capacitors are not suitable for batteries in most of electric vehicles. Yet lithium-ion batteries will likely be the go-to power supply for electric vehicles in near to distant future. Many believe that it is more likely that ultra-capacitors will become more commonplace and as power generation systems during the deceleration. And then I decided to go to our scientific part of the internet. So there is something that is a electric double layer capacitor, and the double layer is formed as an interface between the electrode and electrolyte to store the charge. But the funny thing is that the electrolyte is lithium ion electrolyte. So it's like that, exactly used in lithium ion batteries. Some information is in the contract in terms of power density. The supercapacitor of electric double-layer capacitor can reach up to 40 kilowatts per kilogram. So think about it, 40 kilowatts per kilogram. Your average power that you need in your household is about 6 to 7 kilowatts per hour. And the lithium battery is only 1 to 3 kilowatts per kilogram. Now, kilogram is 2 pounds. So we're talking about 40 kilowatts per 2 pounds of weight. So in terms of charging and discharging time, double layer capacitor can reach a second, level of a second. The high capacity capacitor is at the level of minutes, and the lithium battery is at the level of hour in charging. The high reliability features in terms of operating temperature. The operating temperature range of lithium batteries is minus 20 to plus 60. But if you use capacitor, you have minus 40 degrees to 85 degrees. Now, we say, what is 85 degrees for those not familiar with Celsius? 100 degrees of Celsius is a boiling water temperature.
Leslie?
Go ahead.
Okay. Kilowatt is not an energy. It's not an amount of energy. It's a rate of energy. It's how many kilowatts for how long is energy. And that's the energy capacity of something, say, a lithium-ion battery. Lithium-ion batteries have a lot greater energy density than capacitors do. They might be able to supply a large amount of current for a relatively short period of time. They don't have the energy capacity that batteries. Batteries are chemical reactors. They do have electrolytes, and they do have insulation between the electrolytes to let the batteries do the chemistry and such. But capacitors are not chemical reactions. They're just simple capacitors that store charge that is given them. That's why they're able to store the charge quickly, whereas batteries have to undergo reverse chemical reactions, which take a little bit of time. So the bottom line is right now, the reason why no one is using a supercapacitor as a battery, unless it's a very, very low current requirement, you know, like an electric watch, is because you'll drain the capacitor rather quickly, and then you'll be stuck with no power. So that's the story with that. Another thing I'd like to find out is how much his array of ultracapacitors cost if they're significantly less than a lead acid battery or significantly more than a lead acid battery costs.
Of course, I agree with you. I didn't formulate properly. So if you have a battery, then we have a capacitor of the battery measured by amount of watts per unit of time. So we have a 4 amp hour for the small battery that is used in the alarm systems. We have, actually, I don't remember, what is the capacity of a car battery for a small car?
Offhand, I do not recall. I'm not a big car guy. Anyone out there know the approximate power storage capabilities of a standard automotive lead acid battery?
Yes, somebody else in there. They usually go by cold cracking amps, so you could convert that, I guess. Back to yours.
Okay. Well, the other person that was doubling with Paul?
Yeah, there was another station there.
Only Highway 2 now headed west. I have a comment. Kind of off, on topic, kind of off center. Can I make a comment?
Okay. Okay, on topic, off center. Let's hear it.
While I lay in my hospital bed on with my friend on FaceTime in Germany while he was up in Amsterdam, I asked him, what's going on with the electric cars in Europe? He says, oh, they're everywhere, especially in Holland. They redid all the streets. They have charging ports on every other parking spot. I said, what? He says, yeah, every Dutchman has a Tesla. Government helps them pay for it. And in Germany, everybody's driving around electric vehicles, all the factory owners and everybody has big Mercedes, and all the well-to-do people have the big SUVs, and the poor people have the smaller ones. As we're all going electric. Everybody's going electric in Europe because they redid the entire, everybody has a charging port, in other words. The government's putting in charging ports for everybody. Opposite of the United States. We're way behind with our infrastructure, according to my friend. We had a long discussion about that. And according to my friend over in Europe, they tore up the streets and put in charging ports everywhere. We are way behind with the infrastructure. So just to throw that in there, back to net control.
Okay, very good. Glad to hear another voice. I don't know. I've mentioned in the past that I think the concept of going all electronic vehicle is not viable. Battery, lithium, and the rare earths needed to add to lithium, and how you deal with used up lithium and recycling it all is going to be a major pain in the backside. And there's a lot of large companies that Japanese companies have said, great, wonderful, we're not doing electric vehicles. We're going to figure out something else. And so who knows what they'll figure out. I do not think that the world is going to shift over to 100% or even 50% electric vehicles. We could use better infrastructure for EVs. Like most things, our infrastructure has been allowed to degrade and fall apart. And hopefully in the near future there'll be more investments in infrastructure in the United States, which will probably include charging capability as well. But again, I don't foresee a EV future where everyone has their EVs. And you know, you mentioned SUVs, which is very popular in the United States for a bunch of reasons, including tax loopholes. Tesla doesn't have an SUV. Tesla has their high-end cars. The vehicles that they have been promoting, there's a truck that I think there's about five of them on the road someplace, and no one's seen them. There's that futuristic thing that's a car, sort of. It looks like it can't be manufactured, so I don't think that's going to happen. So other companies are jumping into electronic vehicles, and, you know, we'll see how that works out.
Yeah, it's the Mercedes SUV. They're all big on over in Europe. That's the EV. For example, the journey that I'm making right now that I'm speaking to you in wouldn't be viable with an electric vehicle. Just what we're doing right now, today's journey, wouldn't be possible, most likely, with an electric vehicle going on this round trip of about 500 miles. I don't think it would be viable, especially on a blizzard, perhaps a blizzard or something. It wouldn't be safe to do it with children in a car, with an EV, on Highway 2. There's nowhere to charge, there's nowhere in between, there's no rest stop. Full tank of gas in my Jeep would get me 600 some odd miles. But there's no charging stations in between. You know, so that's my comment. I agree with everything you just said. And over in Europe, they have these charging stations every so on. Everything's uniform, everything's set up by the government. But everything's degraded in this country, and it's done, you know. You're going to have to rebuild the whole infrastructure in this country, which is not going to get done that way. You know, I agree with you 100%. I just thought I would throw that in there to break up. Maybe some people want to hear something different other than, you know, scientific values and so forth. Just, back to that control.
AC2GS. Okay, Ken, thank you for participating. Yeah, I mean, the United States has different needs. We have a lot of wide open spaces, and we have a lot of people going from A to B that kind of stretches the ability of electronic vehicles. Electronic vehicles are probably really nice in urban environments. But, you know, you take them on the roads for a long enough distance, and, you know, it takes time to recharge them. It takes more time to recharge them than it takes to fill a tank. So there's going to be pluses and minuses, and I'm sure there will be a place for electronic vehicles. In Japan, they're thinking about hydrogen-based engines. They're thinking about ammonia-based engines. I'm not really quite sure why you'd want to use ammonia as a fuel. Having worked in a chemistry lab, if a little bit of that comes loose, that's very painful on the nostrils. So I thank you, Ken. If anyone out there can answer Rich's question, Wesley's question? What's the power capacity of a standard automotive lead acid cell battery?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I was doing the math with the 600 cold cracking amps for my car. But anyway, I came out to around 50, and I found a website that says, sure enough, the average is between 40 and 80 amp hours. 40 and 80, that's the average for a regular car battery. That's only one website. I don't trust that. I usually go to more than one, but that's what I found so far.
Okay, that sounds legitimate. I was looking up capacities for lithium iron phosphates and cross-compiling them with automotive batteries once upon a time, and that sounds like a number that I saw looking there. So, yeah, I think there's a wide range. You know, there's the cheap ones and there's the deluxe ones, so that's probably where you get that range of 40 to 80 amp hours. So that's your answer, Wesley, 40 to 80 amp hours.
Good, thank you very much for that. So we were talking about sample capacitors, ultra capacitors, and I mentioned about electrolytes. And now we're going to lithium-ion capacitor, lithium-ion battery, lithium-ion capacitor. We're trying to find out what is the difference between them. Would eventually those capacitors be able to replace the batteries? But at first, we're talking about a second level. So it's not the second level, level of a second in charging, comparing to level of an hour for regular car battery of charging. So a lithium-ion capacitor is a hybrid type of capacitor classified as the type of supercapacitor. It is called a hybrid because the anode is the same as those used in lithium-ion batteries, and the cathode is the same as those used in supercapacitors. And it does have an activated carbon. That actually reminds me the youth of mine and youth of most of the guys listening to us. And those small children were taking apart the battery, and they saw the rod, the black rod,
that was inside. So it's actually a rediscovery of the technology that was present 60 years ago, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, with small addition to it. Back to you.
AC2GS. Okay. Batteries are batteries. Batteries are chemical reactions. Oxidation redux reaction, in which electrons are shuttled around through the contacts of the battery instead of the solution. So you have two different, an anode and a cathode of two differing electronegativities, and the difference between the two determines the voltage potential, and when the chemical reaction is spent, the energy in the battery is gone. Some of them you can reverse the current into the battery and force the chemical reaction to go backwards to recharge the battery, but there are some batteries that the chemistry doesn't really deal with that very well. So there are rechargeable chemical reaction batteries and non-rechargeable chemical batteries. Capacitors are different. Capacitors are simply charge storage devices. They have two conductors and some insulating material in the middle. With electrolytic capacitors, you have electrolyte because the current actually helps to form the insulating film that is the dielectric of the capacitor. So that's why there's electrolyte in electrolytic capacitors. Non-electrolytic capacitors do not have electrolyte. And the electronegativity of the two pieces of metal in a capacitor do not affect anything. If anything, they make no sense, because if you use, say, lithium as an electrode for a capacitor, it's expensive and it's dangerous. You can get a much better conducting material, and it will give you the same capacitance. So they're different animals entirely. Batteries are chemical reactions. Capacitors are charge storage devices.
Yeah, I agree with you. The only thing is that both of them use iron. So we're talking about electrolytic capacitors, and we're talking about the batteries. So the anode of lithium-ion capacitor is made from carbon material, which is often pre-doped with lithium ions. So this pre-doping process lowers the potential of the anode and allows the relatively high output voltage compared to other supercapacitors. Anyhow, it was discovered in 1981. And that was in Japan. I believe it was Kyoto University. Kyoto University. Right. So many years passed by, and now we haven't. I only wonder why it's taking so long. The guy in the video was showing the capacitors that he had for 20 years, and they were still holding the charge. it's interesting to see where the technology goes. In my car that I have, my lead acid battery was working properly for a number of years, and all of a sudden one day I parked the car and it couldn't start it any longer. So it wasn't like low battery, no, not at all. But I was fortunate enough that at that cross section there was a store that was selling car batteries. I was able to replace them. Anyhow, back to you.
Okay, thanks, Wes. I mean, you never quite know where technology will lead us. You know, anything's possible. Lithium ion and the other types of lithium batteries have been manufactured for many years now. They're the go-to high-density rechargeable battery technology. The problem is you have to end up paying for the high density, with the fact that occasionally they suffer from thermal runaway, and they explode. And, that's chemical fire, much nastier than most fires that people tend to just pour water. You can't pour water on a lithium chemical fire. So, but they're still looking into different technologies. They're looking into aluminum-based batteries. They're looking into anything that has graphene. You know, if you want to make some money on the stock market, start some kind of a business that does anything you want to do and say the word graphene, and you're probably going to have at least a few guys from Silicon Valley who will throw at least $10 million your way. And, who knows? Maybe someone will actually figure something out. We were talking about blue LEDs for many, many, many years in the 80s and the 90s until the Japanese discovered the technique to make blue LEDs, and now blue LEDs are all over the place.
If you have any questions, then I go to the next subject.
Okay,
Paul, WSON on a battery.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, just for the heck of it, the Perseverance rover and Curiosity rover that are riding around on Mars, they each have, well, like Perseverance has two lithium-ion batteries, but they're big. I mean, you know, on Earth anyway, each one weighs like 30 pounds. On Mars, it's like one-third weight, so each one weighs like 10 pounds on Mars. But each one is, the total, and you know, you have two big batteries. The ones back up, you know, they run them in parallel as well. In case one does fail, they can cut one loose from the other one. But each one has a 43 amp hour capacity, so similar to what a car would be. The difference, of course, these are lithium ion, so that's pretty good. You know, of course, they're constantly being recharged by the radioisotope thermoelectric generator, the RTG. You know, it's got that nuke on board, charging the batteries all the time. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
Okay, that's very good. Yeah, I think lithium iron phosphate batteries come as high as 40 amp hours. You know, amateur radio operators use them for all kinds of emergency use and portable use. So that's good to know. Yeah, I mean lithium iron has kind of changed commercial products. I don't know if anyone. I'm sure everyone here remembers the bad old days of cadmium. Nickel-cadmium with their memory were a pain in the backside. I mean, nickel metal hydride was decent, but, you know, the gold standard these days is lithium, either lithium polymer, lithium ion, or lithium iron phosphate. So, thank you, Paul. Leslie?
I believe there was one more person.
Okay, is there someone else? If there's someone else who wants to make a comment, please do.
It's WB2BXO with the comment.
Sure, Frank.
Yeah, on the situation of Europe, countries are putting in, totally converting, sounds like rather rapidly, to electric vehicles. I think the economics of fossil fuels of using gasoline is quite a bit different in Europe. Gasoline is a lot more expensive, and people don't, my understanding is people don't drive very much because of that. Of course, the railroads are supposedly much better in Europe, and ours are right up there with Pakistan. In any case, so the economics is much different. Here, gasoline is much less expensive, believe it or not, than in Europe, is my understanding. So the argument to convert to electric is a lot less compelling. And, of course, to change anything in some countries like the U.S. and probably, to a certain extent, in Germany, is that somebody has to make money for change to happen. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's usually how business works. There's always someone's nephew who just so happens to be in that business. Yeah, I mean, the dynamics, the economies are all different. The United States produces a great deal of gas. It's very weird. We buy foreign gas, but we sell our gas to foreign sources, and whereas Europe has very little production of gas, at least Western Europe, and that puts it, they have to deal with Russia that has most of the gas, apparently, in Europe, and that's made a mess out of everything the last year or so. So, yeah, there's a whole bunch of different dynamics. They're a little bit less anxious about nuclear energy generation than we are. There are European countries that are still building nuclear reactors and will probably continue to build nuclear reactors, and I wouldn't hold my breath for a nuclear reactor being built in the United States in the near future. So, yeah, there's a lot of complicating things that interact with why people do the things they do. But ultimately, it tends to kind of boil down to making a buck.
Okay.
Yeah, apparently, a nuclear plant is being built in Montana. But Europe is obviously doing a lot more of that. I think Poland is just broken ground on a new nuclear plant. I think France is largely dependent on nuclear. Anyway, the economics of energy in Europe, my understanding is a lot different than the economics of energy here.
I would agree with you, Frank. Different places have different dynamics. They have different forces acting upon them, and you can't just graft one country's solution onto another country without understanding the underlying reasoning behind it all. So, again, you know, everyone kind of jumps to the next gee whiz technology without thoroughly investigating things. When Al Gore kind of promoted these green credits, a lot of people kind of jumped on that as a wonderful idea until all the grifters out there made loads of money by conning people into selling them non-existent green credits. They would lease a forest and not burn it down and take that as a massive green credit to sell companies that were burning a lot of fuel. So, you know, these things are well meant for the most part, but often they don't really work well. So you always got to give new ideas a little bit of a time, a chance to people figure out what the angles are, what the grifts are, and to act accordingly.
Okay. So let's go to the next subject. For years, I was benefiting a great time from the friendship with Dr. Roy, just because he is critical to many subjects, and it's absolutely priceless. That is priceless. For science or for technology, you need to have somebody who is able to take critical approach and manifest that critical approach with the sense that could convince the opposite party. So thank you for that, Dr. Roy. We have a subject that where I have a opposite opinion to Dr. Roy. It is not much known for the audience, a phenomena where one drop of water can create enormous amount of energy in the presence of arc, electrical arc. And Dr. Roick had a different approach, standing that it is possible that all of those PhDs might be wrong. And these PhDs are from Oxford University, from North Eastern University of Boston, from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and many others. And there are like 30, 40 names. They put on paper, actually, under the statement that arc liberated chemical energy exceeds electrical input energy. So when I was talking to Dr. Roy, he brought up a number of arguments which are pretty smart and pretty good, and I just made a simple analogy that you cannot have more energy out than you put in, because when you put the energy into the system, then you have a losses, and the amount of energy out is always smaller. Unless the energy that you use is energy that is triggering reaction or borrowing energy from another process. So if you have a small mechanical force on the primer at the bottom of the shell, it can create a chemical reaction of the gunpowder, resulting in a motion of the projectile in the ammunition. Or if you have a pipe connected to the river and you use mechanical force of your hand to open up the valve, then you don't pay for the water, you just pay for the energy used to open up the valve, ladies and gentlemen. And that could explain why in some processes we have more energy out than energy delivered. There was about 90 years of history of that that unusually strong water arc explosion experiments and observations, and they were investigating sudden electrodynamic conversion about one-third of the water into the dense fog, and eventually they used high-speed photography to reveal the fog, that the fog expels itself from the water at supersonic velocities, and the loss of intermolecular bond energy in the conversion from the liquid fog must be the source of explosion of energy. At the same time, in another article, they say that there could be two aspects of this, that the shock and the shock sound waves propagated from the expanding arc channel, and the bulk pressurization of the enclosure if arcing is taking place with the closed volume. But there was recently, a few months ago, Dr. James, Jaynes, and he presented a video where he showed that one drop of water could manifest, in presence of the arc, could manifest two chunks of copper spreading in extremely fast with extreme power away. So actually, what it looks like, he put one chunk of copper at the table, then he put one drop of water, and then he put another chunk of copper on the top of it, and then he used the aluminum foil to create an arc, where the other electrode was also an aluminum foil that was at the bottom of the lower part of the copper. And he was presenting different amount of water he put in and the explosion that happened. The reason that I'm talking about it is that we have a number of high voltage transformers on the poles that are blowing, and we might think what the energy for that explosion is coming from. Okay. I would like to... there is one more thing. There is a quote from another material, and there are five scientists on it. It says, the most powerful explosion so far observed is 7 newtons to the material projectile, or about 3 pounds mass. The strength of the impulse is scaled proportionally to electromagnetic action integral for arbitrary chosen current pulse shape and magnitude. The plasma explosion in the salt water is much more powerful.